I'm Christopher Lyden, and this is The Connection. The news from the Microsoft decision this week is that the government will not tolerate old-fashioned monopoly in the new economy. The attraction of the open-source software idea embodied by Linux is that people become a kind of humanopoly of users. Linux is the leading contender among open-source operating systems. It's the product of thousands of volunteer programmers who collaborate over the internet, continually fine-tuning the code and making it available for free to all takers. For super-savvy geeks, Linux has offered spiritual nourishment in its pure programming satisfaction, as well as the ultimate in customization. For the rest of us who just want to plug and play, the thought of being our own systems administrator can be downright terrifying. What most of us don't know is that we're already using Linux when we read our email or surf the web. Big companies like IBM, even entire countries, are adopting it too. We're talking about Linux this hour at what could be a tipping point. Our phone connection, listeners, is 1-800-423-8255. Our guests today are all key players in the world of open source software. Miguel de Icaza is the founder of Helix Code. He's a young pioneer in developing open source applications that compete directly with Microsoft. He joins us this hour from Mexico. Bob Young in North Carolina is the co-founder and chairman of Red Hat, which is the leading champion of getting Linux into the mainstream. Andrew Leonard of Salon.com is with us from Berkeley, California. He's the author of the online book titled The Free Software Project. Good morning, gentlemen, and welcome to all of you. Our phone is 1-800-423-TALK to make the Linux connection. I suppose the big question here is really whether bad news for Bill Gates is going to be good news for Linux and good news for all of us. Can we handle it? 1-800-423-8255. Bob Young, I wish you'd get us started. You're the sort of the brand name retailer out here. What should we know about Linux, and why should we want it?
Golly, got a couple of hours. I'm not sure a single hour show will do justice to that question. But
all Linux all the time from now on.
Absolutely. The way we explain it, what's driving the enthusiasm of this, is that there actually has been a major problem in the software industry, the way that industry has been structured for the last 30 years. And it's simply this, that in a free market system, the customer is supposed to be in control, and the vendor does what the customer or what the market requires them to do to be successful. In the software industry, other than, you know, perhaps initially when you choose the product you decide to use, on an ongoing basis, the vendor is in control, and the customer has to do what the vendor allows him to do. And this is a function of the proprietary model that software industry works. You only get the ones and zeros your computer can understand, but worse than that, you get it under a license that prohibits you from improving or adding on to the technology you're using. So if it doesn't do what you need it to do, you're kind of out of luck, and you have to put up with whatever missing elements are there. What's driving Linux in this open source movement is we're simply fixing that problem. We're putting the customer, the consumer, back in charge of the products he's using. By giving the consumer the source code and a license that allows him to do whatever he needs to do with the source code, it's a little bit like, you know, we're giving him a car where for the first time he can open the hood so he can fix it himself, or he can take it to one of 10,000 other dealers if the first dealer doesn't look after him properly.
Well, there's the dilemma right there. I mean, there are some people who dread opening the hood of their car. There's some people who want to be guaranteed that they'll never have to open the hood of the car. Or, more, you know, it's really more like sort of saying you can make any kind of pizza you want, but you'll have to spend the day at it. A lot of people like frozen pizza, and they don't want to make a single decision about it.
Oh, sure. That used to be the argument that the old communist regimes used to make, saying, we know how to look after our people better than the free market Western systems, because, after all, how many pairs of shoes do people really need? Our state factory will produce the official pair of shoes, and everyone will wear those, and they'll be reliable and trustworthy and useful shoes. Well, of course, you know, I haven't seen that many people in Eastern Europe desperate to go back to the Russian or to the old communist system.
Well,
in effect,
you spun
allowing
the politics here. But I mean, again, it's simpler than that, isn't it? It's sort of like, Mom, did you make this cake or did you get it out of a box? We like boxed cakes, or some people do.
Yes, that's exactly right. So, in other words, what we want is we want to have our cake and we want it to eat it, to use your example. We want both a solution. We really don't want that technology at all, but we do want to have control over the solution we're using. And so that's what's driving this. Companies like Red Hat, we work with these literally hundreds of thousands of engineers across the internet in order to produce products that are simply more reliable and more trustworthy than the ones you can buy from the proprietary vendors. But our customers aren't really hoping to get more technology from us. What they want from Red Hat is help in solving their business problems, and that's what we're set up to do.
Miguel de Icaza, I think of you as a kind of evangelist for the Linux idea. What's so great about it?
Interesting. Well, I couldn't have put it better than Bob Jung just did. He just used a terrific example and was marveled by what he just said. We're basically doing this for giving people freedom and giving people choices, a number of freedoms that they don't get with the proprietary software, which is what he just mentioned. The right to make changes to the software and make the software do what they need to, and the right to make the software to fix problems on the software that the vendor might not want to fix. So you can have your own staff in your company, or you can have if you're a programmer, you can actually make the changes and contribute back to the software that you've been using. And this changes a lot the way you use software. You're no longer waiting for periods between, I don't know, 95 to 98 to get your next operating system upgrade. You can get the upgrade as soon as you need it, and you can fix the problems on demand.
I wish you'd sort of explain it to me. I never really knew how to fix my car. I don't know how to, you know, tweak my software if I had the opportunity. Where would I begin? Where would somebody like me, sort of a chronic and not particularly happy Microsoft Windows user, start using the opportunity that Linux gives me?
Well, you could definitely begin by sending the problem to your IT staff and say fix it, right? You don't have to do it yourself if you don't want to, but your IT staff is going to be empowered to actually get this task done, something that they cannot do with proprietary software.
Yep.
Or you can hire a company or a third
party. What might I ask the IT guy to do?
You would say, here's a problem. The word processor is not printing, or the word processor is crashing whenever I enter this sentence. Please fix it. So the IT department would say, well, we're going to fix this problem. If you find one of those blue screens that happens on proprietary systems that crash your applications, you can say, here's what happens. I have this problem, and the application is making this, which doesn't let me work. Please fix it, and the IT department will have the tools and will have the knowledge and the power to actually fix the problem for you. If a feature is missing in your application, you would like your word processing application to do something that the vendor hasn't designed or hasn't included into the system, and that's probably one of the reasons why Apache is so popular on the network right now, is because you can adapt the software to your needs instead of the needs of the original program designer. So it molds to your needs. It's not you who adapts to the needs to the features the software has.
Say I want to redesign a prettier database of all the kinds of people that we talk to in the connection, and all the connections among them, all the economists, all the poets, all the preachers, all the musicians, all the harpsichord players. Can I fine-tune something like that on Linux that I couldn't on Microsoft?
I guess it depends a lot on your specific task. I guess you can do the same on Linux, the same application you're talking about. I don't see any problems with that.
What does it mean that Linux is spoken of as a free software? Free in the sense that it's open source, we can play with it, but also free of charge.
Well,
is it or isn't it?
Well, the way Richard Stallman puts it is that the free software comes with a number of freedoms. One of the right to use the software, the right to learn from the software, the right to modify the software, the right to make copies legally of the software, and the right to redistribute your modifications and improvements to other people. And typically the side effects of these freedoms that you grant to people are that the software tends to be more reliable, the software tends to be more robust, the software tends to be faster, and tends to use less resources because there's many eyes that are looking at the source code, many eyes that are polishing and tuning and making sure the software does what it's supposed to do. So with this peer review process, you tend to get better software than proprietary software. And it also tends to be developed much faster than proprietary software.
Andrew Leonard, you're the historian of the Linux movement, so to speak. And it was a cloud no bigger than a man's hand just 6 or 8 years ago. Bring it to this point.
Well, before that, I think I'd like to tweak a couple of the things that Bob and Miguel were just saying that might help illuminate why this is so exciting. And the first is, you know, you or I, as people who use word processors or spreadsheets, we don't want to get into the code ourselves and fix it. You know, having access to the source code doesn't mean anything to us. Having other options does mean something to us. Not having to buy a new computer to run, you know, the new version of Word is a little attractive to us. And so the kind of the excitement of having an alternative out there that, you know, we don't have to get into the code, but knowing that, okay, it's possible that other, you know, software applications will come to us that we could use that free us from the dependence on one supplier, that's a kind of exciting thing. And the other thing is that Bob puts this in terms of customers and vendors and, you know, serving the customer. But free software and open source software have always been about programmers serving themselves. Programmers like to tinker, they like to hack, they like to play around with the code, and they will do that. It's kind of a core cultural and philosophical value of programmers. And their own tinkering has resulted in a culture that includes not just, you know, Linux, but the entire internet. The internet is built on the principle of sharing code with other people, giving tools to other people for them to build whatever they want to build. And so, you know, you and I sitting in our word processor might wonder, you know, why do we want the source code? But then we get on the internet, and without the community of programmers that has been working in this tradition of sharing code, we wouldn't have the internet. As for how did we get here now, you know, that's a question that you could write a book about. But Linux is just the latest part of a tradition that goes back at least 50 years. Just 3 weeks ago, I was sitting with a reunion of programmers from the 1950s who had all worked on IBM's first commercial computer, the 701. And they worked at West Coast aerospace companies, Lockheed, Douglas, the Rand think tank. I mean, this was Cold War economics. They were flight testing fighter planes and building missiles. And they all had this huge room-sized computer that didn't have any software. I mean, the most basic software for actually building software.
Okay.
And they got together and collaborated on building the tools to use this computer. They were working for different companies. They were competing for the same government contracts. But as programmers, they understood, look, it's a lot better if we all figure out together how to write a tool that we're all going to use than all write our separate tools. And so this is, as soon as programmers started working with software, the philosophy of sharing code was integral to their efforts.
Linux, of course, has grown exponentially in the last year, 2 years, 3 years before that. And yet here we have the moment when Microsoft is about to be severed in two. How does that intersect with the growth of Linux? And what does it imply about the future? Bob Young.
The whole Microsoft case is interesting to us. The primary value of the case, of having the Justice Department, if you like, police the industry, you know, patrol the streets in our industry, has already been felt. It has enabled Red Hat to build business relationships with companies like Dell and Compaq and IBM and Hewlett-Packard historically, without the Justice Department patrolling the industry, would have been very difficult for us to do because of Microsoft's well-documented tendency to threaten and to close down channels of distribution to their competitors. But what's interesting to us is that problem has a little bit already been solved simply by the Justice Department investigating. What the stage we're into now is almost of historic interest. It's a little bit like, you know, a murderer who was going around killing people, and then because a policeman started patrolling the street, he stopped killing people. And we're now at the stage of deciding what punishment that murderer should undergo for the murders they previously committed. It's indifferent to us at this point as to whether Microsoft is or is not punished. That is the Justice Department's job to resolve. Our job, and all the case has enabled us to do, is access to the market. Unless we can deliver a benefit to the consumer, whether he's a corporate consumer or an individual, that Microsoft or Sun Microsystems or IBM can't deliver, we won't be successful. And the one thing we can deliver as an industry is we can deliver control over the technology to our customers. And it is that control that is really driving this. But to extend on something that Andrew was touching on, what's fascinating when you start thinking about this in a bigger picture sense is there's a reason that programming languages are called languages. They are, in fact, a form of expression. And in the same way that our legal system depends on transparency, you know, a lawyer, when he makes his case in front of the Supreme Court, can't copyright that argument and charge every other lawyer royalties for using it. That argument becomes part of our legal heritage. Our whole society benefits from the contribution that lawyer made to our legal system. And that's really the model that we're moving towards in software development. We're treating software as a form of expression, as simply a language, and we're saying we can build better software and better tools if we all share, if we have the ability to take feedback from our customers and enable our customers to build better systems because we allow them.
Bob Young,
as partners.
Who are the customers that are going to make the choice of Linux as opposed to Windows? I mean, it won't be me, right?
Salon.com.
Yeah. There's actually three categories of customers. There's the server customers, people like the search engine guys, Google, Yahoo, all run their technologies on open source systems. There's the desktop space, where Microsoft currently dominates, but companies like Helix Code, Miguel is doing fascinating things to bring... these open source Linux tools to the consumer on the Intel desktop. But the other one, and the more exciting piece, is this new internet appliance model, which in fact will be of great value to you and to the non-technical users, because it solves the problem that the PC represents, which is the PC, in the end, is a pretty complicated piece of technology.
This is the post-PC applications, Palm Pilots and wireless and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. And all of that kind of thing, as they connect these to the internet, need much higher reliability than the traditional proprietary software development model has ever been able to deliver. And that's where open source is going to become. If you like, you know, what we've done as an industry is we've let the genie out of the bottle. The consumer now knows that he can get the source code and a license that allows him to modify it from vendors like Red Hat. And, you know, when we talk to customers who are working with open source or free software and say, would you go back to the proprietary model? They look at us like we're nuts and ask us, are we kidding?
Connection listeners, are you ready for the Linux moment? Whether it's out of annoyance with Windows or exasperation with Bill Gates in the Microsoft case, or maybe just all of our migration out of the PC world into something new. Are you ready for Linux? Open source operating systems. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Linux connection. Maynard is on the line. Hello, Maynard. Hello, Maynard. Are you there? Try it again, Maynard. 1-800-423-8255. Charles is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Charles, are you there? Let's try it again.
We must have done such a good job answering the questions that they've all hung up.
Can we blame Windows for this? I don't think so. And maybe AT&T. Let's try it again. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone to the Linux connection. Who's on the line? Adam, are you there? 1-800-423-8255. Bill Gates must have jam the phone lines. Let's go back to any of the fundamental questions about the software. I noticed there's a kind of there's a little bit of red baiting in the whole discussion here. I think Bob Jung originally wanted to make me the kind of Eastern European communist, even for thinking that everybody should have one style of shoe or one style of software. And yet, there is a kind of socialist model in all of this, too. Socialist sort of cooperative, from each according to his programming talent, source of all this magic, and also a mystery of how you make money in the long run on a free product. Who wants to tackle the sort of the old socialist question about Linux?
I would like to mention that that it's not really about a socialism. It's in a way going back to the fundamental thing that built computer science in the first place. It's taking the computer industry into being a science again. You build on top of what other people have built in the past. You're not supposed to build from scratch every time and reinvent every time everything. People are used to computing concepts, and they just want to keep using them. So we want to build on what other people have developed. We want to build on top of what other people have invented, and we definitely want to reuse all that knowledge and all that code. So in a way, it's basically making computer science again a science, and benefiting from the traditional scientific discovery work.
Miguel, what's the model for that kind of thing? I mean, in what other kind of industry has this kind of principle applied?
Well, it has been used. I mean, you're not paying for the, you're not paying patent, you're not paying licenses on patents for how you use your light in your house, or how the various systems that have been researched over time used in your house. Is that the question?
Well, I'm just wondering. I mean, the underlying question is how you build a profit-making capitalist development model out of this whole idea.
Well, you have to think in terms that the software.
Not that that's the ultimate
commodity.
Good, but go ahead.
Software is going to become a commodity, and what you do is that you sell services around this commodity, which has a very small price. So you build either support services. You treat your customers well. You provide packaging services, and you make what your customer needs, and that's how you make money, by providing services around this commodity, software is going to be.
Even more fundamental than that is the fact that people keep asking me, "Wow, you know, this free software thing—it's so radical. Where else could it be applied?" And I scratch my head, going, "Except that's the way the rest of our society, the rest of our economy works. It's unique to the software business that we have this feudal model where the vendor controls the customer and not the other way around." Sam Walton at Walmart didn't get to be as successful as he became by doing bad things to Kmart or Sears. He did it by doing uniquely good things to his customers, such that customers preferred to shop at Walmart. And the retail business is, if you like, an open source business. You can go to Walmart, you can learn how they do things, you can build your retail store on the principles that Walmart invented, and then extend those principles to provide an even better service to your customers if you choose. Again, it's only in the software business where, on the one hand, you don't have to divulge what goes on in your technology, but worse than that, you get to sue anyone who even attempts to use the innovations that you were able to build because of the code that went before you. As Miguel says, our scientific tradition, what has built this society, is the idea that we share knowledge. That this is not a communist concept. This is very much a democratic free market concept.
I haven't got it yet, Bob
Jung. The software
industry
doesn't work that way.
I don't have it yet. In this system of shared sort of open formula, no secrets about what we're doing here, where are the opportunities that investors are going to sink real money into?
All right, let me give you a specific example. Take a look at IBM's profit and loss statement. IBM are well known for making mainframe computers and servers and ThinkPad laptops, but you look at their profit and loss statement, they don't make any money selling hardware. They make all their money in the services and support area. In other words, most customers of technology don't want technology. They want solutions to their business problems, and they're willing to pay companies who will solve their business problems. And so all we're saying is we're going to follow the IBM model, take it to an extreme. We'll give away the product, and we will make a lot of money selling services and support to our customers through the internet on a highly leveraged model. We build it once and we sell it many times in a services sense. Our customers get high quality service at a dramatically lower cost than has ever been possible before.
Miguel de Icaza, or Bob Young, I mean, Miguel, who are your customers and what do you charge them? What kind of service?
Well, we're a startup company, so right now the customers we're targeting are OEMs, Linux distributions, and in the future it's going to be the consumers directly. I just want to say that Bob Young has been doing a lucid explanation of all these things, and I couldn't have it said better.
Thanks, I'd like
Miguel.
To jump in, though. This is Andrew from Salon.com. Bob Young's example of IBM is interesting because IBM may be making money now, but it is not making the kind of money it did when it had a complete monopoly on its hardware and software, when it could charge whatever it wanted to and often did. The thing that that I think Wall Street got a little bit overexcited about last year with respect to the new Linux-based companies was they're thinking that one of these might become as big as a new Microsoft or a new...
Andrew Leonard, hold the thought. We'll be back after a short break. We're talking about the Linux moment on The Connection. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Linux Connection. Is the world ready for open source software? All the more because of the troubles of Microsoft. And is Linux software ready for us? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Linux Connection with a lot of Linux pioneers out there on the line already. Miguel de Icaza runs Helix Code. Bob Young in North Carolina founded Red Hat. Andrew Leonard covers all this for Salon.com, and he's written an online history of free software. Our phone's 1-800-423-8255, and let's hope they're working. Maynard is on the line.
Hello.
Maynard, thanks for sticking by us.
You can hear me.
We can indeed.
Okay, excellent. Chris, I really want to thank you very much for this program.
Well, thank you.
I've been using Linux and free software now exclusively since 94, and I very much like the software. It's extremely stable.
You're an early adapter, we call you.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. There are some people out there that are, were earlier than
Maynard, what does it do for you that Windows doesn't do for me? Be as concrete as you can.
It's very stable. I can leave my computer on for over a year without it crashing.
Hmm.
Absolutely. However, I do have a question that I'd like to bring up regard to the politics of this, because large software companies like Microsoft are using the legislative process to combat free software. This is with regard to, say, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, USITA, which you've brought up in a previous program, and also patent law. For example, the new Microsoft Windows media streaming format, that's a video format called ASF, is patented now, and it is illegal for free software authors to reverse engineer this proprietary format in order to use it under Linux or any other free OS. Microsoft Word documents are another great example of this. If you receive a Microsoft Word document as an email attachment,
yep,
you must have Windows in order to read it.
Yeah, and not everybody does, yeah.
That's right. They are using the legislative process to essentially, in a way, criminalize the use of free software. Not necessarily criminalizing the creation of it, but criminalizing the ability to be standards compliant with the rest of the world. And I'd very much like to hear what your listeners have to say about that. And I'd also like to say one last thing about Helix Code. I downloaded GNOME 1.2. Which is the latest release of Miguel's package, And that is the slickest install I've ever seen. It is extremely nice.
How do you download it?
All you have to do is enter one command, and the whole thing happens automatically.
And what does it do for you?
The software package is a desktop, very similar to Windows. But the niceness, what makes it so nice, is that you just, once you install it, all you have to do is click on one icon, and it automatically updates all of your software packages for you. Hmm. So not only are you not spending money for it, but it's extremely easy to upgrade your software for bug fixes.
I'm going to try it this afternoon. Is it going to work for me, Miguel?
Yes, it should. There shouldn't be any problem. I think Joe, who is the author of that program, is going to be very happy to hear your comments.
Do you want to respond? Who wants to respond to Maynard's general question?
Yeah, I'd be happy to take a crack. I'm sure Andrew has strong opinions on this one as well.
Bob Young, Red Hat. Go ahead.
That's right. The interesting piece of patents and copyrights is, while we all acknowledge they are inherently good things, what we haven't been debating very clearly as a society is you know, how much of a good thing becomes a bad thing. You know, so in patents and copyrights, what they are is there's no inherent right to be able to restrict others from using some new innovation, given that you generally came up with your innovation by building on things that went before. But we as a society have decided to give people rights to control their innovations in order to give them an economic interest to innovate. But at some point, we can, in effect, give away too many rights, because at the moment that we give some corporation, whether it's IBM or Microsoft or AT&T or anyone else, a patent on something, we are saying you have an effective monopoly on that idea for the next, you know, 20, 30 years. And the people who suffer when we give a right, the right we're giving away is from the rest of the citizens of our society. And we're restricting their ability to ever use that innovation. And the problem we've had is the legislatures are looking at patents and copyrights as being good things, which they are, but are not, you know, sort of even looking at the concept that maybe, you know, that there's an extreme beyond which we don't want to go. And as a result, they keep expanding copyright and patent rules. And we think, as the caller quite correctly pointed out, that we're now taking copyrights and patents into areas that they were never meant to go. And we as a society are beginning to suffer from that.
Maynard, is that the answer you expected or wanted?
Pretty close. And I would absolutely agree. I'm quite concerned by how these large companies, not just Microsoft, but many others, are using the legislative process. And, you know, Microsoft is pouring huge sums of money into Congress, and they're using that to bend legislature for their own gain, and that frightens me. You know, many other companies do this in other business sectors, but this particular this particular business sector concerns me because it's how I earn my living.
Yeah, point taken about copyrights. We've been there before, and it sounds reasonable. I want to move on. 1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. Charles is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts.
Great program, as usual.
Thank you, Charles. Light dawns on Marblehead, as we say, right?
I guess, I think the model that I would, the analogy I would make is, when I started in this messing with computers in college in the 60s, we had a big mainframe and we were all hooked up with a terminal. And when the desktop came along and I got into Mac in 84 and freed me from that that mainframe, I thought I was a liberated person. And it sounds to me like Linux is going to do that also, but unfortunately only for those who are technically skilled. I would argue it's not free, and it's not free because you heard earlier that if you want to do this, Chris, you're probably going to have to get your IT person to come and help you install something, or your system will get totally screwed up.
We got such a nice IT guy, though. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, but those of us sitting in our little homes have trouble with it. I think that the whole Linux thing is marvelous, and isn't it going to just split the market? And aren't we really seeing the whole Windows concept and everything sort of like the last Iceman? And if the government would just say, okay, we proved our point, now we're going to go away, won't the Linux thing just constantly grow and grow and grow?
Charles, you raised this Apple Macintosh correspondence that, I mean, I've been, it's too amateurish. I thought it was too amateurish to ask, but you're really saying what I wanted to ask, which was, isn't Apple, the old Apple computer in relation to PCs, now the PC relationship to Linux? We thought, you know, 10 years ago, I thought PCs were too complicated for me.
Right.
And well, I still think Linux probably is, although I'm going to try this, I'm going to try Miguel software this afternoon. Is that your question, though? I mean,
yeah, I think so. Thank you.
Thank you. Who wants to answer it? Andrew, maybe?
Yeah, I'll jump in. Just the following up on the Apple connection, first I'd say that it's not just the relationship between Apple and the industry. It was the personal computer in general, you know, was a more democratizing development. But raising the Apple case in particular is interesting because right now some of the same people who created the Macintosh desktop are working on a desktop for Linux, you know, the Easel guys. And I'm sure Miguel can talk about this a lot more than I can. But that, you know, right now Linux is not easy to use for the average user, but there are some very, very smart people with a long record of success working on it. So, you know, as a reporter, I'm watching pretty closely. We could see some pretty exciting things within a year or two. I mean, Miguel works a lot more closely with those guys, I think.
Miguel?
Yeah, these people they're referring to, it's the Easel people, Andy Herzl, and the other hackers that build the original Macintosh are working on GNOME these days. And the objective is to make the computer very easy to use. Not only very easy to use for people who are already used to computers, but also make it easy to use for kids and other people who have never before expressed any interest in computers. So you have to rethink many of the user interfaces if you want kids to take the full to take full advantage of a computer, for example, or people who really don't care about computers and they just want to use an appliance. And I think that has been the focus of the GNOME project for the last year, trying to simplify the user interfaces, polish the little details, and make sure it's easy to use. It's no longer about having functional software, which was the original objective, having a functional desktop. It's no longer about having a functional desktop, but having a perfect desktop that adapts to the user needs. Mm-hmm. I think the caller got confused. When I mentioned the IT department, I mentioned the IT department in the context of having them customize the software, doing what that programmer would do for you. The idea behind GNOME is to empower users and have these people and have people use the software and be productive with it without having any training at all in computers. You should be able to be productive with a GNOME desktop in a few minutes after you begin using it for the first time. You just have to learn some very basic concepts, which are the same basic concepts you learn when you start using a Macintosh. And you should be productive as soon as the system is up and running.
Fair enough. We're talking about the Linux Moment connection, listeners. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Adam is on the line.
Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Adam.
How are you?
Good.
Thank you so much for having the show. This timing, as always, is perfect on this. I just want to try and stitch together a few of the things I've heard from the perspective of, I guess, somebody who's been in the industry for a long time. One of the things that has been talked about is that there are, in every software company, there are two cultures. There's the culture of the programmers, who are naturally collaborative people because they recognize that their work is optimized if they work together and break down barriers between their what they're trying to produce and what other people might be able to. And then the rest of us, whose job it is to make money and reward investors and make the enterprise economically viable. And it's sort of like a Cerberus. There's a two- or three-headed dog, and everybody's always biting at one another when you try and do a software enterprise. What Linux has now done has come in and basically, because we've gotten to a point of the technological evolution where this can happen with the Internet, Linux lets programmers do what they want to do, which is problem solve, tinker, party, and not have to worry about how are we going to make money with this. On the other side is this idea of a service company, which is what Red Hat is, which is brilliant because it appropriately bifurcates the market. It says, one, we're going to have this development thing that goes on without really needing monetary reward because the programmers are tinkerers and like to do this. And then you've got another piece which is going to address the customer's very real and important need to be supported and to have an organization behind that support that they can rely on over time because they don't want to have to constantly reinvent the wheel every time they have a problem. But the problem with to bring this back to Microsoft, what you end up with a company like with Microsoft, which is why we're seeing this big reaction, is you end up with problems like the Melissa hole, the virus hole, which was put in by a group of people in Microsoft who wanted to connect all the applications over the objections, I'm sure, of the programmers who saw it as an obscene security risk. So this is a sort of an evolution, and I think it's the thing that I just wanted to, the point that I wanted to make was that this is kind of allowing each of these entities to be what they want to be naturally, without having to do a lot of the external, without having to be thrown together in sort of an unholy marriage.
Bob Young, I wonder, is Adam right about the two cultures in your company, for example?
He's absolutely right. I used to sell Unix workstations in a previous life, and the disconnect between the engineers who had to make these things work and the sales guys like myself who were talking to their boss's boss about, you know, convincing them to buy it was quite remarkable, because in the end, the engineers were beholden to, you know, the guys in my company who built these things. And I'd regularly overhear conversations between the engineer trying to install it and my engineer trying to support him. And my engineer would be, you know, his engineer would be saying, you know, will it do this? Because this is what we needed it to do. And our engineer would be going, who the hell sold you that piece of junk, kid? It doesn't even, you know, not a chance. In this case, what we're doing is absolutely empowering the people responsible for making this stuff work, which is exactly why the earlier caller was making the point that, you know, his machine will run for a year at a time, in fact, many years at a time, without breaking. It's changed the model. You are the guys using the stuff are no longer beholden to the vendor. If the vendor ships it with a bug that causes the system to crash, the user can fix the bug so his system will work. The problem with the proprietary license is that, you know, sort of if you fix things to make your systems more reliable, or if you add features to that your users need, you literally, according to these proprietary license, can get thrown into jail for improving the technology that you're being asked to build your business on. It's a flawed model.
Okay.
And the open source free software model simply works better.
1-800-423-8255, the Linux connection and the Linux moment. Christopher is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Christopher.
Hi. I really like this whole idea about open source software. And earlier you were talking about, your guests were talking about copyright law. I was wondering, this is kind of, I'm asking you to speculate on this, is that does the open source model have any lessons for, like, the Human Genome Project and, like, the technologies after computers, you know, because I'm, it seems to me that the things, I'd hate to see like a Microsoft who's in control of our genes and our human, you know, our DNA.
I'm not clear about the connection. You're not talking about mutating softwares, are you? Are you talking about?
He's talking about copywriting information.
Yeah, copywriting information and how, you know, the open source model works. I don't know. I'll let your guests comment if they...
Andrew Leonard, do you want to take a bite out of that one?
Yeah, I think I know kind of where he's going. The open source software is kind of the... is partially a result of this really interesting contradiction of modern times, and that's the point. That's digital information is really easy to copy. And, you know, Microsoft has this huge problem of spending billions and billions of dollars trying to stop people from copying something that is really, really easy to copy. Mm-hmm. And anything that is digital now has that same problem. You know, what we're seeing with Napster and music is this, right, is the same issue. Anything that's digital is easy to copy. Open source software has looked at that and said, okay, we're not going to make that our weakness. We're going to make that our strength and say, since it's easy to copy, everybody can share it and go off and do what they need to be doing, you know, in their own business, which might not necessarily be software. It's a much harder question when you're looking at the entertainment industry, you know, how are business models going to be built on the fact that this stuff is so easy to copy. And with respect to the genome, it goes beyond, you know, the entertainment industry has a gripe about Napster, but as the human race has an issue with anybody getting control of the information that makes up our own bodies. And we've got to come to some realization as a society that information is so easy to copy that trying to control it not only may be impossible, but it also may not be healthy for us. And we've got to look for other ways to, you know, build businesses and build economies around that.
Yeah, I think this is actually a very important point and does relate to the point Miguel was making about how our society works. We build, you know, we can build these incredible things. We can send people to the moon because the people responsible for that have the opportunity of standing on the shoulders of giants is the expression, you know, it's this concept that what if, you know, the basic laws of mathematics had been copyrighted and were now owned by some, you know, massive corporation whose job it was to maximize their profits based on owning that information. So there's a real conflict in our society that it's very important that we all focus on the benefit of keeping knowledge in the public domain where anyone can use it and anyone can build on it versus the need of the patent holders to be able to finance the factory necessary to build, you know, the computer that they've innovated and built, and they need a return on their investment. There is a conflict there, and we have to have intelligent debate to resolve it.
1-800-423-8255, the Linux connection. Keith is on the line.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Keith.
I want to make a comment about maybe from a programmer's standpoint. It seems to me that one of the great things that Linux is doing for the industry, or more for the programmers involved, is it makes it exciting to work in it again, whereas working with some of the big monolithic corporations like Microsoft, the tools they give you, you know, it makes it very, very restricted, as you say, that they really, really try to guide you in how you do things. Whereas, you know, when I first started getting into programming, everybody was giving away everything they did. I remember reading a magazine article when I was an early teenager saying, and the cover of the magazine said, I'm going to give you the code for this entire word processor. And sure enough, in the pages of this magazine, this whole word processor code was laid out. You could enter it, you could change it, you could modify that, and it's just starting to come around again. And it's kind of like it's like a renaissance where people who, back in the late 70s, people who were never computer programmers before, with the advent of the PC, became programmers. It was like a hidden, latent talent that they didn't even know they had. It's starting to pop out all over again.
I just hope I have time to learn it, Keith.
Yeah, I agree. It's very worthwhile. The other thing I'd like to say is more on a business standpoint. One thing that concerns me about Linux is the fact that, and this is kind of another kick to the concept of the IT department helping out when you need a customization. So far that I've seen, every single IT department I've ever been involved with, Linux is still kind of on the sidelines for whatever reason. People want to accept it, people want to use it. You get this pressure coming from the users, but it's kind of like, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a good mechanic, he'll take you in his back room and show you the Jaguar he's putting together from tiny parts. That's kind of the way the IT staff is treating Linux, because the corporations still have yet to accept it seriously. I know that's starting to change now, but it seems like you really have to work for a very large corporation before you have the kind of IT department that has a skill set necessary to get involved in the programming level.
We're just going to have to study it harder, Keith. Thank you. I want to ask Miguel de Icaza once more, what is the desktop office system that I can install this afternoon that will introduce me to the whole Linux practice?
Oh, well, it's a GNOME desktop. It's available typically on Red Hat systems by default. This just happens to be the new release we released 2 weeks ago. It's the latest and greatest. And you can get it from www.gnome.org, or you can get the easy-to-install version from our website.
I'm going to look for it this afternoon. Andrew Leonard, you've given us some of the history here. What's the future? 3 years, 5 years down the road.
The first lesson I learned reporting about the computing industry is never predict what's going to happen next week. If you'd asked me 2 years ago, would a company like Red Hat or VA Linux be stunning the stock market with public offerings, I said, no way. I think what we're going to see, though, is more and more companies using open source tools to do their own business. You know, we get always caught up in these conversations with how does this affect the end user? You know, what can I do as a person?
Right.
I'm not sure that's the most important thing at all. The most important thing is for individual enterprises and companies that have something that they want to do, for them to be enabled to do it without being beholden by licenses to Microsoft. I think if you look at beyond the borders of the United States, this is where it's most interesting. Microsoft's...
We got to go, but we'll keep our eye on it. We'll remember what you said. Andrew Leonard from Salon.com, Bob Young from Red Hat, Miguel de Icaza from Helix Code. Thank you for joining us. Listeners, you can continue all this on our website at theconnection1word.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by eForce, a systems integrator delivering industrial-strength e-business solutions in Internet time to dot-coms and major corporations. eForce, on the web at eforceinc.com.